king, God came to Solomon and said, ask me for anything. Ask me for anything and I'll give it to you, Solomon. And with that kind of one wish, I'm not sure what I would have chosen, but Solomon said, I ask for wisdom. Wisdom so I can lead your people well. And God was very impressed with that request and said, Solomon, I will make you wise. I'll give you that. And besides, because you've asked so well, I'm going to give you all those other things you didn't ask for. Riches, power. Solomon was a special man. When we say that Solomon became wise, it's something that we think of kind of in a small sense. Well, when people came to him and he had to judge, he made wise decisions. That's not what God gave Solomon. God gave Solomon much more than that. God gave Solomon brilliance. Solomon was a genius. Solomon was smarter than anybody perhaps that ever lived. Solomon knew everything, it seemed. Solomon was so high and lofty in his thinking that it was unbelievable. He was handed the highest position in the land. He was the king. He was given immense wealth. But Solomon, with all this wisdom that God gave him to run God's people, also was a genius when it came to running Israel on their natural levels. Solomon looked at Israel and said, this place is too big. I got to reconfigure all the districts. All these administrative districts need to be set up by me so I can get them done right. And he did. Solomon divided Israel into unbelievably important districts and set up leaders over that. That was just one of the things that came to his mind. He appointed all the leaders. Solomon was in charge, we learn, of all the commerce of Israel. Anyone who wanted to do trading, any kind of trading that Israel did with other nations, came through Solomon. Solomon had all the answers. He was that smart. Then Solomon put his mind to building Israel, building projects. I'm going through a building code official class right now, and what we have today boggles the mind. Solomon had to do it all without these codes. He knew how to make things work. He was the head of extensive building projects. Besides that, when God said he made him wise and smart, he made him artistic. Solomon could write music. He could write poetry and literature. We know of 1,000 songs that are given to Samuel's pen, Solomon's pen. He was the wisest man alive. But all this power, all this influence added up to one thing. Leeches, users, con men and opportunists. Those people who wanted to saddle up to Solomon to get all that they could from him. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to consider builders wanting to get construction project contracts from Solomon. Would-be political figures jockeying for headships of new districts. They would go to Solomon. Merchants desiring special commerce trade agreements would go see Solomon. Scholars and theologians seeking new inspiration, seeking new knowledge, and seeking to have their name put towards a little notoriety would see Solomon. Don't forget about that musical ability. Now, I don't know, but he sounds like he might have more groupies than the Jonas Brothers. 1,000 songs, at least, that we know of. The literature that Solomon wrote. Solomon was bombarded by people with agendas. Solomon was bombarded by people with plans trying to advance their careers, trying to advance their personal programs. People who spent time figuring out how to play Solomon, devising in their head a strategy of what to say and what to do to obtain their hidden objective. In most cases, these schemes usually centered around gaining a higher position, gaining more money, or even procuring just something they didn't have. And now Solomon, in this passage, speaking through the Spirit of God, proclaims that this kind of evil scheming, this evil kind of self-promotion, is despicable to God. Thank goodness you and I don't have to deal with such people, huh? Well, I guess things haven't changed much. I knew I was working with a man once who had a bad drinking problem. And I didn't appreciate the fact that he would take his drinking problem onto the roads and often drive drunk, leave the bars loaded. Well, one day he got pulled over. One day, the cop stopped him and gave him a breathalyzer test, and he came up over the limit and said, whew, thank goodness, get this guy off the road before he kills somebody. Well, he came to work one day and he was telling me, you know, I talked to a friend. I got a friend who knows a little bit of something. And he said, you know, that there's certain medicines over the counter or even prescribed that if you take them can give you a very high breathalyzer test. He says, I'm going to put the wheels in motion on this. I never thought in a million years he'd get away with it. But he did. He knew something, figured out some kind of scheme, and walked away from that scot-free. He's driving on the road drunk to this day. Last time I saw that guy, I thought of the schemers. Schemers are still around us, folks. And what God has recorded for us here is to help you and me make sure that we don't start scheming in our lives. Yeah, it's written for us. It's not written for that guy. He needs to read it for himself, but you and I need to read it for ourselves. So let's use Solomon's experience to help us set our course correctly on how God wants us to live. The first action step we need to apply to our life when we look at Solomon's life is this. False friendships out. Let me tell you about two guys I worked with. With the fire department, the way we get promoted is we have to take a test. And this test is very extensive. You have to study a lot of books to pass this test. So I knew two guys who were friends. And these two guys came together and they said, here's the deal. Here's what we'll do. You read these five books. I'll read these five books. That way we cover all 10 books. You write down the highlights. I'll write down the highlights. We'll get together and we'll teach each other what we should know out of each of the books. And they said, that's a good idea, friend. This will work out. This will be great. Until along the way, one of the friends told somebody else what his plan had been. He held back some of the really important information from his buddy so his buddy wouldn't beat him on the test. And they took that test. They never talked to each other again once the word came out on what had happened. I thought, false friendships. These false friendships are the relationships that we make merely because they're advantageous to us. Buddying up to a supervisor, false friendship. Flirting with the geek who knows how to pass the test, or even schmoozing a king, like 1000 BC with Solomon. Solomon learned that there's little love, very little love in these false friendships. There's very little respect, and there's little concern for the person themselves. No, instead, false friends lay in bed and they determine who would be the most profitable to further advance their cause. Who is it that will get them closer to their goal? And if in the end their wicked scheme means that the other person gets left behind or left a little worse off or wronged in the process, well, that's acceptable because the schemer just wants to get himself further along. Westbridge, false friendships need to be taken out of our repertoire. They make God sick to his stomach. And instead, we need to replace that action with this, a magnanimous attitude in. Here's the positive side. This is the flip side. The repenting, the turning from what's bad to good. What does a magnanimous attitude look like? How is it defined? Being magnanimous is to be generous. It's to be big-hearted, charitable, and helpful. I love what Luke 6:35 says. Jesus said this, help and give without expecting a return. You'll never, I promise, you'll never regret it. Luke 6:35 gives us an opposing view held by God. This is what God likes. Instead of being a schemer, a taker, God is asking us to be ingenious givers, smart and thoughtful givers. I love about the first time I ever heard of a CARS ministry out in Chicago. There was a man who was having breakfast with his pastor, and he told his pastor, I really don't have anything I can do for the church. I really don't have anything I can give to anybody. See, all I had to do is fix cars. I don't have any kind of gifts that a church can use. And the pastor said, well, you know what? I got an idea. I have a couple of single moms whose cars really don't get kept up very well. They don't get their oil changed like they're supposed to. They don't change the brakes when they start squealing. And I was wondering if maybe, why don't we just pick like a night that you could come to the church and I can have those couple of ladies come and the church will pay for the oil and the filters and the brake pads and you could change them for them. Would that be something you'd be willing to do? He says, I'd love doing that. That's awesome. And that was the beginning of an incredible cars ministry that supplied all what was needed to maintain these vehicles for single moms, hundreds of single moms, and gave cars that were worn out, refurbished by this man who had no gifts. Give those cars to single moms who needed them. That's ingenious giving. That's a magnanimous attitude and a magnanimous heart. I wonder what Solomon would have written if someone had come up alongside him and asked this, is there anything I can do to help you, King? Is there anything you need? By the way, no strings attached, not looking for anything. Just wanted to give to you. Although it seems like you have everything, let me ask. Well, you don't have to have a car ministry to be magnanimous. It can be something that God asks you to give or Scott asks you to do that's very small, but it's priceless in other people's eyes. I found some videotapes when we were cleaning out the basement recently, and it was videotapes of when Kelly and I first started doing ministry together back in 1989, and we were doing coffee house ministries. And we did a coffee house ministry, and here we are, prominently standing up, you know, in a basement, playing our music, and there was a fellow there who was playing a bass, and I saw it, I remembered. His name was Doug. Now, I remember when we started this little band, and we didn't know what we were doing, we said, Doug, we need a bass player. He goes, you know, I don't have a bass, so I'd love to play bass. I know how to play bass, but I don't have one. Things are tight. I don't have it. And I remember somebody else in the band who had been playing guitar, and he said, you know what? I have a bass. I have a bass that's in my closet. And he brought it in, and he gave it to Doug, and Doug said, this will be great. I can borrow this and play this. This will be great for the band. The guy said, oh, no, no, no. Not borrow it. You can have it. Doug was floored by that. That someone would give him a bass, which was probably worth about $100, but to Doug was the end of the world. I ran into Doug 15 years later. He still talks to me about that bass. Now he still plays it for Jesus Christ all these years later. Someone with a magnanimous heart gave that to Doug. It wasn't worth much to the guy who gave it, but it was worth everything to him. Okay, false friendships, out. No way. None of that. Magnanimous attitude. In. Let's look at our next piece. Manipulation. Out. I can think of no better way to explain this to you than to let the drama team. Oh my goodness. Four dramas next week? Oh my goodness. You don't want to miss the anniversary. Oh, those taters. Love them. The schemer knows if they share just the right information, doors can open. Just like Aladdin trying to find magic words that will open the door to his treasure, the schemer determines what lies and even more so what half-truths they should share and what truth they should not. I remember several years ago, they changed the way the civil service test was being done throughout the whole state of New Jersey. They added something called biodata. I didn't know what biodata was, but they sent all these preliminary tests to us who were already firemen. So we need some help. We're developing biodata, which will be used on the entrance exam. It'll count for 30% of whether or not you get hired or not. So we got these biodata tests, and it didn't matter to us. We just took them so that they would have some type of material to work with. And it asked questions like, how many friends do you have? How do you get that wrong? Have you ever been late to work? Have you ever been fired? Do you have a good relationship with your father? Now, how in the world are these tests going to help? Well, the truth is, what happened was the answers to this test were some of the state was looking for. And after the people figured it out, there were companies that said, we can tell you, you can come to our class, and we will teach you what the right and best answers are. Not truthful answers, just the best answers that the state wants to hear. The ones that will help manipulate that test, that biodata, in your favor. I couldn't believe it. You would go into this test after learning this new biodata and give them all of these incorrect statements. You wouldn't give them truthful answers about your life. You would just give them the answers they wanted to hear. And as you and I head back into our workplaces, opportunities to manipulate are going to present themselves to us. Maybe it will be an opportunity to talk a person down so that we can make ourselves look a little bit better. Maybe it'll be manipulating a relationship to assure that it goes the direction you desire. Once again, this is not what God intended for us. Instead, we have an option that will please God's heart. Manipulation out, but a selfless heart in. I didn't know, but there is an award that is given out during the Olympics that no one talks about. It is the highest, most coveted award someone can get at the Olympics, but it's never been televised. It's never been made a big deal about. I didn't know about this award until I started reading about it. This award is called the Cooperton Medal. The Cooperton Award, and the one that strikes me as being the most interesting, the Cooperton was given out in the 1964 Winter Olympics to a man named Eugenio Monte. The Cooperton Award is an award that's given out to one athlete throughout the entire Olympics who has the best sportsmanship. Funny, that never got televised. Never to this day has it been televised or even talked about. But in 1964 at the Innsbruck Olympics, Winter Olympics in Germany, there was a bobsled competition that was going on. And bobsledding is big stuff in Europe. It may not be that big here, but it's big in Europe. And Eugenio Monte, who was running for the Italian team, had the number one fastest time. He had had his preliminary runs, he had done his runs, and he had now come in and was in first place. And the only team that was really in contention to beat him, the only team that would even stand a chance, was the English team, who were very good bobsledders. Well, as Eugenio Monte was at the bottom of the run, he heard that the English team was having trouble at the top of the hill. Apparently, there's an axle bolt that goes onto the runner, and it got sheared off somehow, busted. And the sled, there were no extras back then. The sled would be put out of commission. The English were ready to run, but their bobsled was broken. They were the ones who could beat Eugenio Monte. And when Eugenio heard about it, he ran to his fellow bobsledders and said, "Help me." Flipped his sled over, unbolted the same size bolt that the English team would need, and ran it to the top of the hill to give it to the English team so they could get their run. Guess who came out number one on the bobsled run? The English team. They beat Eugenio Monte and took first place. He wound up in third. But at the end of that competition, at the end of those Olympics, very quietly among only the athletes, the de Cooperton medal was given to Eugenio Monte. I guess the question that you and I are left with tonight is, where are the axle bolt moments in our life? Where are the times when God will ask us to have a selfless heart, where we think of other people instead of ourselves, to not manipulate a situation to make things better for us, but instead to make it a situation that we want to be best for somebody else, even where we give, maybe at our own expense? You don't have to be at the Olympics to have that happen, gang. This can happen to us anywhere. In your neighborhood, on the road, in your schools, in your workplaces, God will give these moments. And he'll ask us to please him with what we do with our lives.